This is such an exciting time in the life of our church. My name is Pastor Bobby, and I'm going to be kicking us off with our Multiply Sermon Series. It's going to start today and go over the next 3 weeks. If you are newer here at Mercy Hill, this is a great time to jump in because hopefully you're going to get to see our church at its very best over the next 3 weeks as we talk about our mission as a church to make disciples and to multiply churches all around the world. So today, we're going to be talking about the topic of faith. And this Multiply Sermon Series over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at three different stories in the Bible that help us to see what do we need to have as a church to get us from where we're at right now to where we're going in 2020. You see, we're going to be talking about our vision as a church. Yes, it's to make disciples and to multiply churches, but what does that look like in 2020? Like, what does that look like over the next year? How could that play out over the next year? And we, as a church, what is going to be our role to see that mission and that vision go forward over the next year? So today, specifically, though, we're going to be talking about faith. And no matter where we're at in terms of our journey with God, I think all of us deal with this exact same thing when it comes to faith. And here's what we all deal with. We all want to see the hand of God move before we step out and have faith. We want to see God work in some particular area in our life before we step out and have faith. You see, we want our faith to be reactive, meaning, God, I want to see you move, and then I'm going to react by having faith because I saw you move. And what we're going to see today is that God, and this is what faith is proactive. Faith is, I believe you, God, so I'm going to have faith in this particular situation in my life, and I'm going to trust that you are going to move. And you see, a lot of times there ends up being a battle between us and God. Us wanting faith to be reactive, God wanting our faith to be proactive. It makes me think about our son Everett turned six this week, and when he turned six, we said, hey, what do you want to do for your birthday? He's like, I want to go to IHOP. I was like, okay, boy, after my heart here, who doesn't want pancakes on their birthday? But you think about that age, 6 years old, he's been going through a bunch of milestones over the last couple of years, learning to ride a bike, learning to swim. And I remember when he finally learned to swim, right before that, there was such a battle between him and I because I knew that he could swim, but he just didn't believe that he could do it. And so we would try to convince him, and we would say, hey, buddy, we know that you could do it, so we're going to stand right here 5 or 6 feet from the edge, and you just got to stand on the edge. You just got to jump in and swim to us. Like, we know that you could do it. He's like, uh-uh. Unless you hold me while I'm jumping in, there is no way that I'm jumping in. And so I tried to come up with all these different ways that I could convince him that he could do it. You know, I was like, hey, I'll take a mask. Look, and as you swim, I will swim under you like this as you're swimming so you can see me, that I'm there to catch you. Or I'll swim next to you, or we'll get a raft and we'll go next to you as you swim. And he's like, uh-uh. Unless you hold me, I'm not jumping in. And he's the only kid that I know of that learned to swim with one arm, because at the beach, this is what he would do. Because he was afraid to swim, he would get in the pool at the beach and he'd put one hand on the side of the pool and then he would just swim back and forth like this. And so he literally learned to swim with one arm before he could swim with two arms. And this battle that him and I would have, this is the battle that we have with God, where God is like, hey, just trust me, just jump in, just have faith. And we're like, uh-uh, unless you show me, unless you work out the details, unless you hold on to me, there's no way I'm jumping in and just simply trusting you. And so today, I think for all of us, this could end up working out in so many different ways. For some of you, this could just be you're deciding whether or not to believe and follow Jesus. And so for you, the battle is, God, I want all this knowledge of you. I want you to confirm your existence. I want you to work all this stuff out. And God is saying, hey, just step out in faith. I mean, for all of us that have followed Jesus at some point, I bet you 99% of our knowledge about God has come after we believe. For some of you, this could be, hey, you feel like God's calling you to some big thing in your life, you know? Maybe it's adopting or foster care, and you want God to work out all the details, and God's saying, hey, just step out in faith. Let me worry about the details. Some of you, it could be, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be talking a lot about generosity. And you know, hey, I'm not where I should be in terms of this. And you want to say, God, get me out of debt. God, get me a better job. God, I want to have more money before I start giving. And God's saying, hey, you let me worry about all the details. You just need to step out in faith. And the big idea today that we're going to see is this. Faith precedes the work of God. Remember, we want it the other way around, right? We want to see God work. We want to see the hand of God move, and then we want to have faith. But faith in the Bible precedes the work of God. And we're going to see that today in 2 Kings chapter 4. There's going to be this widow that is going through a hard circumstance, and yes, God's going to do a miracle. God's going to move in an amazing way, but God first wants to see her step out in faith. This is just a really cool story from the Bible today, 2 Kings chapter 4. Hey, we're just diving into the Old Testament, so let me give you just 30 seconds of context of where we're at. So 2 Kings 4, this is probably 850 BC, and this is the time of the kings. So God, you know, has given his people these different kings, and most of them end up leading the people astray, leading the people to do things they shouldn't do. And so God gives then prophets to the people, and the prophets are basically God's mouthpiece. So the kings oftentimes are leading the people astray, and the prophets come and say, you need to do this, or the prophets come and speak judgment, the prophets come and speak blessing. And so right here in 2 Kings 4, this is the transition between the prophet Elijah and the prophet Elisha, okay? Now, this has confused me all week because my oldest son's name's Elijah with a J, but today we're talking about Elisha. So if you hear me say Elijah, I really mean Elisha, okay? Got it? So this is the transition from Elijah to Elisha. And so 2 Kings chapter 4, let's jump in today. If you don't have a Bible, it'll be on the screen. Let's look at verse 1. It says this. Now the wife of one of the sons of the prophets cried to Elisha, your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, but the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves. So just setting up the situation, what she's going through, there's really three pretty major things that this widow is facing in her life. The first is that her husband's died. Now, some of you have been there, where you either grew up and you didn't have both parents, and you know the sort of insecurity that can bring, or you've lost your spouse and you know sort of the feeling of that, and this is what she's going through. So she lost her spouse who was a prophet under Elijah, but then secondly, he's left her with a bunch of debt. And we don't know how this happened or why this happened, but we know the Bible, you know, says this about debt, that the borrower can be the slave to the lender, and so she's going to end up actually experiencing that in a real world way. See, the big difference about the debt she was in and the way debt works in our culture is like, yeah, if you're in a bunch of debt and you can't repay it, yeah, that's super annoying that you're going to have maybe people from collections calling you and annoying you, and like, man, that can cause a lot of stress and anxiety. But imagine her situation. It's like you can't pay your debt, so your kids are going to come and be enslaved to the creditor so that they're going to work off your debt over the next 7 years. So she lost her husband, she's in debt, she can't repay it, and she's on the verge of losing her children. Look at verse 2. And Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what have you in the house? She said, your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil. Because she was so poor, my assumption is that that statement was literal. I have nothing in the house except for this jar of oil. So you can imagine, maybe she sold everything that was in the house. You know, it's like when you move into college and you literally have nothing. She had nothing. Nothing was in the house except this jar of oil. And the question he asked her, I don't know why, but it made me think of, a lot of times in the Bible, we see people come up to Jesus or the prophets or, you know, reach out to God and say, hey, I have this need. And what is the response oftentimes? What do you have? This makes me think of Jesus when the people came up to him and they said, hey, his disciples, how are we going to feed all these people? And what did Jesus say? What do we have? Give me what we have. A lot of times what is happening here is God is setting it up for a miracle to happen, and that's definitely what's happening here in this story. Look at verse 3. Then Elisha said to her, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors." Get this phrase, "empty vessels and not too few." Hang on to that phrase there, "not too few." "Then go in and shut the door behind yourself and your sons and pour into all these vessels, and when one is full, set it aside." Okay, we need to understand what's happening here. This is not like, hey, you're baking a cake and you need to go to your neighbor and borrow 2 eggs and some sugar. That's like pretty simple, right? A lot of times your neighbor's not even gonna ask, like, what is this for? Okay, she's going around and borrowing hundreds, maybe over 1,000 jars from people all around her, okay? This was not an easy ask. This is like you going to your neighbor with a wheelbarrow, knocking on the door, and being like, "Hey, I need all of your bowls." And they're like, "You need what? I need all of your bowls, all the bowls that you have in the house." And then you go to the next neighbor and like, "Hey, I need all your bowls." There's gonna be a lot of questions that are gonna get asked, like, "Hey, what, like, that, okay, that's a lot of bowls. Like, what, you know, like, what's going on here?" This is what was happening. God wanted the widow to step out in faith before his hand moved. You see, what we're gonna see in the story is that God was gonna fill up every single one of the vessels that she got. So the more vessels she got, the more vessels that were gonna be filled. Can you see how this is a test of faith? You get a couple vessels, you get a couple vessels filled. You get like 1,000 vessels, you're gonna get 1,000 vessels filled. It makes me think of Hebrews 11:1. Hebrews 11:1 defines what faith is. It says this, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." Think about that. The conviction of things not seen. See, we want it to be the opposite, right? We're like, "God, show me what you're gonna do, and then I'm gonna have assurance in that thing." And God is saying, no. Faith is having assurance in what you cannot see. You see, the other way is logic. We want logic. God wants us to step out in faith. Two of the examples that Hebrews 11 gives, and I think it's good, it helps illustrate this story, is one, the story of Noah and the story of Abraham. What happened with Noah? God's like, "Hey, go build this massive ship out in the desert." And if we were Noah, we'd be like, "God, you're gonna have to convince me there's a storm coming before I build this massive ship and be the sort of laughing stock of everybody in the desert here." Because there was no rain, there was nothing like that. But God said, "No, go build the ship." Remember, the assurance of things not seen, go build the ship because I said this is what's gonna happen. Just like he called Abraham out and he said, "Hey, I'm gonna give you and your descendants all of this land, but first, I want you to go live in the land when it's not your land, when it's their land." You can imagine Abraham saying, "No, give me the land and I'll go live in the land." Like, I need assurance of what I can see, not what I can't see. And God's like, "No, go live in the land and then one day I will give you that land." That's what's happening to this widow. God is calling her to step out and get these empty vessels. So what happens? Verse 5. "So she went from him and shut the door behind herself and her sons. And as she poured, they brought the vessels to her." Get this, here's the miracle. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There is not another, the oil stopped flowing." So the widow, okay, get the picture. It's like they go in and Elisha says like, "Hey, don't let your neighbors come in. There may be a crowd of people. You just borrowed like 1,000 vessels. Go in with just your sons and begin to take that one vessel that you have, pour the oil into the other vessels, and what happens is it begins to multiply." And they begin to see it multiply. You can just imagine, I imagine there is such an abundance of joy and excitement in the situation because they are participating in the miracle. Like they are seeing the miracle happen right before their eyes. I don't know why, but it makes me think of, how many of you have seen the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? Do you remember right before Charlie got the golden ticket, they thought the golden tickets were gone, and then they realized some dude made a fraud golden ticket, so there's still one out there, and he got the golden ticket, and what does he do? He goes and he runs home, he locks the door, and he tells his family, who they were in like abject poverty, and his grandfather ain't got out of bed in 20 years, he tells them that he has this golden ticket.
And the grandfather, he says this. He said, I never thought my life could be anything but catastrophe. But then what do you say? But I've got a golden ticket. And he starts to sing that song, and it's like, man, this one thing is gonna change their life. And this was them. Like, they have this is their golden ticket, because what's gonna happen is these jars get filled with this oil, and then this oil is something they can monetize. Like, this is gonna change her life, her son's life, it's gonna change their future. This is their golden ticket. You can imagine at this point, right, that she'd be like, I should have got more jars. Like, I should have got a couple hundred more jars, because God was gonna fill every single jar. She should have presumed that God was gonna even be more generous, but God filled all the way up to what her faith was. If her faith was 500 jars, God filled 500. If her faith was 1,000 jars, God filled 1,000 jars. And then look at verse 7. This is where the story closes out. She came and told the man of God, Elijah, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your sons can live on the rest. So she collects up all the oil, she sells it, she pays off the creditor, her sons don't go into slavery, and they have enough money for them to live off the rest of their lives. They just experienced a miracle of God. You know, I assume here in this story that the widow knew the promises of God. Her husband was a prophet. The Bible has a lot to say about widows and orphans. You think about Psalm 68:5, that God is the father of the fatherless and protector of widows. I just bet that she was going out and trusting that God was going to provide for her. We see in this story that faith precedes the work of God. Her faith preceded God coming and doing this miracle. Something I've been telling myself all week in terms of this story, we can't multiply the oil, but we can prepare the jars. Multiplying the oil, that's the miracle. That's only what God can do. So we can't multiply the oil. Whatever it is, whatever the particular situation we're facing, we can't multiply the oil, but we certainly can prepare the jars. Faith here in this story, faith for us is preparing the jars. But for some of us, the jars never get filled. Like, we never see the hand of God work in our life. We never see God's blessing in our life. The jars never get filled. So let me just take a moment and maybe try to answer, hey, why is that? Like, there could be a bunch of reasons, but I think there's two major reasons. Maybe why, for us, we never see the jars get filled like she does. We never see the miracle in our life. The first reason is this: we miss God's filling because we come to God in fullness, not emptiness. We come to God in fullness with the jars already full, not emptiness. What do I mean by that? In our culture, 99% of people, this is how they view God, this is how they view religion. You better not dare come to God if you haven't got your life figured out. If you're not ready to be moral, if you don't have it all together, if you're not ready to be generous, you better not come to God. You better come to God full, not empty. But the gospel, what the Bible says, is the exact opposite of that. Like, you can't come to God full. You can't come to God with this offering and say, God, this is what I offer you. We're eternally separated from God because of our sin. And so some of you, you're never experiencing any sort of fullness. You never get filled because you constantly come to God in the lens of religion. God, this is what I have to offer you. Let me give you sort of a practical example of this. So I don't know how many of you have ever experienced something in life where you think of it one way, or maybe everybody thinks of it one way, and then you come to find out there's a totally different way to think about it. So for those of you that know me, you know that for a number of years, I've really loved to run. And over the last number of years, I've really gotten to running these like super long races. So I've done 4 100-mile races in the last 20 months, so in the last 2 years. And as I've done this, one of the big components of that is like, hey, how do you eat? Like, you know, how do you fuel all this running? You're gonna be running for 24 hours, 28 hours. So we've done everything. We've done vegan diet, vegetarian, high meat, low meat, all of it. And over the last year, you know, I'm continuing to try to improve, do a bunch of reading, and a bunch of people that do these ultra marathons like I'm doing, they're on a high-fat, low-carb diet. And it's totally backwards from how all of us have been taught to think about, like, nutrition and stuff. And what they're saying is, hey, you get on this high-fat diet, your body don't even need to take in food when you're running. You can go run 24 hours and need to take in nothing. And they're like, hey, the other thing is, you'll lose weight being on a high-fat diet. And I'm like, come on. You're telling me I can eat bacon every day and lose weight. Is that not the dream of every man in terms of a diet? Because all of us think fat makes you fat, carbs give you energy. That's what all of us think. These people are saying, no, fat makes you skinny and gives you energy. Carbs makes you fat. Like, it's totally different from how we typically think about it. Here's what we need to think about in terms of religion and the gospel. Most of us still are stuck in this, I have to come to God with something in my hands. We still think, even every morning when we wake up, I've got to be good for God so that God will accept me. And the Bible says, no, come in emptiness, not fullness. Pastor Tony Evans, he said this, God wants our faith in poverty, not our wealth and self-sufficiency. But the thing is, and I think here's the second reason that a lot of us end up missing God's filling, is because, yes, we have to come in faith, meaning we come to God with nothing, but God requires that we give everything when we come to him. That's really hard for a lot of us. Because we get the idea of, yes, okay, I can't bring anything to God. I can't bring my good works to God. I have to come to God in nothing. But God, in faith, requires us to give everything. We miss God's filling because we're not willing to give God everything. The widow is willing to give how much? All of it. Elisha's like, what do you got? Here, this is all I have. Like, it's not a lot, but this is everything that I have. And I'm afraid a lot of people are still in church, going to church, but you know in your heart, I'm not all in. Like, there's this component of my life, there's this certain box of my life where this is mine. This part's not God's. God can have this, and God can have this, and I'm all in here, but this component, I'm not all in. Like, God can't have this part. But the thing is, in Christianity, yes, you come with nothing, meaning you come in faith, you don't come with your good works, but you can't hold anything back. Just think about the phrase. What does it mean to give your life to Christ? To give your what? Your life to Christ. What does that mean? All of it. The whole deal. You know what it makes me think of? We had an awesome opportunity this summer to my family and I to drive across the country, and we got to spend one day going to the Grand Canyon. And one of the crazy things I learned about the Grand Canyon is, one, like, a crazy amount of people go there every year, like 5 million people go there every year, especially to the southern rim of the Grand Canyon, because it's more accessible. But the crazy thing that I learned was 99% of the people that go there, they don't take one step into the Grand Canyon. They stay right on the edge. And I'm like, if I'm going to the Grand Canyon, I'm going down to the bottom. So we did all the research to figure out, like, hey, what time do we got to be there? How do we beat the mule train? There's a mule train that goes down every day. Don't want to get stuck behind them. And so I ran all the way to the bottom, to Colorado River, came back up. Amazing experience. When you get, it's a 6 mile descent all the way to the bottom, like a 5,000 foot descent. When you get a mile from the bottom, you get the first glimpse of the Colorado River flowing through the Grand Canyon. It's the most amazing scene. And then when you get to the bottom, you get the experience that most people don't get. You get to turn around and look back towards the southern rim of the Grand Canyon. And it's like when you get down there, it just fills your being. It's just like such an amazing experience. And yeah, it's awesome standing on the edge. But going down and getting to experience the Grand Canyon is a totally different thing. And I don't know whether it's people are afraid they're going to get thirsty, or they're out of shape, or they're scared, or there's risky, or whatever. You know, that's why 99% of the people never take one step into the Grand Canyon. And I equate that, I think, in our culture to Christianity, where there are so many people that, man, they like the idea of Christianity. Maybe go to church, you know, maybe like, man, maybe even in a community group and do some of the things that Christians do, but they're not all in. Like, they haven't actually experienced the canyon. They haven't actually gone down into the canyon and had that experience of what it's like. They've never actually experienced Jesus, like a personal relationship with God. You see, the only way to experience that is for us to be all in. And what's the thing that solves this problem? Like, it's a bit of a paradox, right? You come with nothing, but you're willing to give everything. Like, it's a bit of a paradox when you think about it. What's the only thing that solves this problem? It's understanding what Jesus has done for us in his death, burial, and resurrection. Because when we come to Jesus, we come to Jesus like the widow. What was the widow's problem? She had a debt to pay that she could never pay. She was never, under any circumstance, going to be able to pay that debt without God's help. So what happened? God paid the debt for her, right? Elisha came in, did this miracle on God's behalf, and God paid the debt for her. And until we realize that the debt that we owe God, we can never pay, because we've sinned, not against another human, but against an eternal God, and so there's no way for us to ever pay off that debt. We can never pay the debt that we owe God, and yet Jesus was willing to come and pay that debt for us. This is why 1 Corinthians 6:20 says, you were bought with a price. Jesus paid the debt that we could never pay. And when you get that, you come with faith, but then you're willing to give everything when you understand that. Why is that? What do we get in Christianity? This is the core question. What do we get in Christianity? We get Jesus. That's what you get in Christianity. And Jesus is worth more than anything that we have. Jesus tells so many parables to try to help us to understand this truth. Let me share one of them, Matthew 13:44. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that's hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. So what happens? This man finds a treasure in the field, which this is Jesus. The treasure in the field is Jesus. He finds a treasure. Then he goes, he sells everything that he has. Why? Because he goes and buys the field with that money, and the treasure that's in the field is worth more than anything that he has. That's how in Christianity, when you get Jesus, you're willing to give everything. Because in give everything, are you losing or are you gaining? You're gaining. Like, yeah, you're willing to give it all up, but you get Jesus. You get the treasure in the field. So for some of you, I would say, if you're still struggling with, like, man, it's hard to feel like I have to be all in, maybe you're not getting something about what you get from it. Because when you get Jesus, yes, it's a sacrifice, but it's very easy to be all in when Jesus is worth more than all the stuff that you have. So what's the application for today is this. Demonstrate faith by preparing the jars. The widow stepped out in faith, and how many jars she got was in accordance with how much faith she had. So for us, the application is demonstrate faith by preparing the jars. Are you willing to prepare the jars? Are you willing to step out in faith? Now, this can mean so many different things for all of us in here. All of us are dealing with something different. So what does it look like for you to prepare the jars today? I'll give you a couple examples, but you guys are going to have to fill in the blank because I don't know what step of faith God is calling you to take. Some of you, you may either be a new Christian or you're like right on the edge and you're like, man, I'm not sure about taking that next step. Like, I'm not sure about like preparing the jar to be willing to step forward and get baptized and to take that next step. And God is saying, take that step. Take that step of faith and you will see me work, not the other way around. It could be church planting. You know, you guys know we're planting a church in Roanoke. And I've been there trying to think about, hey, moving my life, moving my family to a new city. And we want all the details worked out. And maybe God's saying, hey, will you prepare the jars? Like, will you go to an interest meeting? Will you prepare the jars by doing that? Will you join the launch team? You think about like what I mentioned earlier, adoption, foster care. Some of you feel like maybe God's calling you to that. And it's like you want all the details worked out ahead of time, but it's like that's not how it works. Maybe you can prepare the jars by starting the application process for that, moving in that direction. Say, God, do what you're going to do, but I'm going to step out in faith. Maybe it's serving. Some of you know, hey, I need to be serving. I need to be using my gifts. Well, would you prepare the jars? Go to No More Spectators. Take a gifts assessment. Figure out where you need to be serving. Take that first step of faith. Some of you, it's missions. You think, I need to go on a mission trip this year in 2020. And I would say, hey, do you have a passport? Like, have you prepared the jars of taking that first step? Maybe it's college students, Scent Initiative this summer. You want to live for Jesus. You want to live on mission. Have you taken that first step and even filling out an interest form for Scent Initiative? You see, I don't know where God is calling you to prepare the jars. But God's calling all of us to continue to move forward in faith, and we're not always going to see it. We're not always going to see what's ahead. That's logic. Of course we would do that. Faith is not seeing what's ahead and being confident that God is going to provide. We can't do one thing to multiply the oil. That's God's work. That's the miracle. But we can prepare the jars. So I want to close today by talking to you, how do we as a church prepare the jars going into 2020? How do we as a church say, God, we want to have faith, and so we don't know what you're going to do. Like, we don't know what you're going to do in 2020, but we can have faith and say, God, here's these jars that we want to see you fill. And as you guys saw in the video before the sermon, Pastor Andrew talked about five multiply ministry lanes. These are just five ways to think about the ministry of our church, to think about all the different ways that we make disciples and multiply churches. The first one's the campus lane. We want to acquire the property in 2020 for our Winston-Kernersville campus. We can't change one person's life in Winston-Kernersville, can we? That's God's work. We can't multiply the oil, but we can prepare the jars. We took a survey earlier this year, right after Easter. 47% of people said they wanted to see the next campus there. And so that's what we're going to do. Since we've planted our High Point campus, we've seen 50 people baptized since Easter in High Point. Like, that's God's work. We couldn't do that. But we prepared the jars by starting a High Point campus. That's what we want to do with Kernersville Winston. We want to acquire that property this upcoming year so that we can start a campus the following year. You think about our college seminary lane. We want to launch a seminary extension in 2020. That may not sound super cool, but let me tell you what that's going to allow us to do. Just imagine the day. You guys know as a church that we're all about college students. Because you reach the campus, you can reach the world. Imagine the day that we reach a freshman at High Point University or at A&T or UNCG, and that freshman comes to Christ, and then 5, 8, 10 years later goes and plants a church out of Mercy Hill Church. You see, a seminary extension center is going to allow us to build that pipeline that we've already started to build so that they could stay here, we could train them, raise them up, and send them out from our church. We've seen 20 baptisms among our college students this semester. Think about this. Last Sunday night, it was our last college service, and we were going to do baptism. We had nobody signed up. But we said, you know what? We're going to prepare the jars. And there have been students that we've been praying for by name, our staff praying for them. And 7 students came to Christ and got baptized last Sunday night. That's God's work. Only God multiplies the oil, but we certainly can prepare the jars. You think about our No More Spectators lane. We know that God upholds the widow and the fatherless. This is why we want to see 200 kids adopted or fostered within our church by 2025. And so for us, that means a huge focus on that in the upcoming year. We're going to have a sermon series at the beginning of the year. We're talking about starting an adoption fund. There are so many things we're talking about doing. We can't save one kid into the family of God, but we certainly can have a heart for the orphan and be generous towards the orphan and trust God and put out the jars and say, God, you work among us. You think about our church planting lane. Jesus says, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We're planting a church in 2020 in Roanoke, a church that we hope will plant other churches. Can we change one person's life in Roanoke? No. That's God's work. Only God can multiply the oil, but we can put out the jars. We can say, God, we're going to trust you and plant a church and trust that you'll use that church to reach people in the Roanoke Valley. You think about the last lane, the international missions lane. You heard it in the video. We want to start. This is just one thing among so many things we want to do. A compassion project in Central South America. A lot of you, a couple years ago, we did the compassion experience here at Mercy Hill. My family did this. We sponsored a child. And the cool thing about starting a compassion project is we get to help start a school, a church, all in one place, and then all the kids can get sponsored from Mercy Hill, all in that same particular area. And we could see them grow up and learn and come to know the Lord and all of that. That's just one of the many things that we want to see happen in 2020. You see, we can't save the nations, but we certainly can prepare the jars by sending people out to the nations. So how is all this going to happen? This is where our multiply offering comes in. With our multiply offering, we want to take up an offering in December that will fuel all of these things in 2020. You see, I believe all of these things are going to happen, but the timetable of them is going to be directly correlated to this offering. Because the leaders of the church, we help to set the vision of the church. Here's where we're going. Here's what we want to do. But the congregation sets the pace of that vision. Meaning the generosity is what ultimately fuels the mission. So whether those things happen at the beginning of the year, the end of the year, the following year, the pace of the mission and vision is going to be set by the congregation. This is why we're calling you guys and all of us to be generous at the end of the year so that we can fuel the mission in 2020. So how are we thinking about this? Just my family personally. I'll just kind of share the way we're thinking about this. So for us, some of you weren't here 2 years ago, but 2 years ago, when we started a Together initiative, we had been a family that probably 10 years before that had always been, we always tithe. We always tried to give 10% towards the mission. From when I first became a Christian, I learned that. That's what the Bible teaches, so that's what we always did. Well, 2 years ago, we felt like God was really challenging us to move that to closer to like 15%. And so over the last 2 years, we've kind of focused on two things. One, trying to give closer to that 15%. And I don't say this to boast or anything. I just want you guys to think about this is how we're thinking about it, to help you think about how you should think about it. So that's one of the things we've done in the last 2 years. The other thing we focused on is paying off consumer debt. We just felt called to like, hey, getting our student loans, getting debt paid off so that we can have more margin. To one, it's just wise to live with margin, but two, to be able to give more to the mission. And over the last 2 years, where we're at 2 years later is like we're just in a better place in life. Like, I don't know how it all works, but God just sort of blessed that. God blessed us giving more, and God blessed with us living with more margin and not having stuff have such a hold on us. And God's just blessed us. And so we're looking at this multiply offering, even though we got to finish our Together commitment. And we're saying, hey, we want to give more than we committed. And I'm not saying you need to do that. That's just the way we're thinking about it, because we're like, hey, we're in a better place now than we were 2 years ago. So why shouldn't we give more? We've seen God work in our church. We've seen God work in our lives personally, in our family's life. So for you, this can mean so many different things at the end of the year. For some of you, this can mean a stock gift. You may get stock from your company. The market's in a good place. For some of you, this could be a big end of the year gift. For some of you, this can mean you don't give at all. So you want to start tithing. Like, you want to be obedient to what God is doing in your life, and you want to start tithing. So I don't know what this means for you, but we want to see the entirety of the church sacrifice so that we can fuel the mission and the vision of 2020. 2 Corinthians 9:7, as Pastor Andrew said in that video, each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Look, there is no pressure to give. There's no manipulation to give. Like, this is between you and God. And if you're not giving with joy, then don't give. Like, giving should be a joyous thing. Because in giving, we recognize, God, you've given me so much. Like, you have given me so much. It's such a small thing for me to open my hands in generosity. So our hope is 2 weeks from now that we would come together as a church and give this offering on December 12th and 15th. Next week in every seat, we're going to have a giving envelope that you can just take home. You could pray over that. For some of you, it means finishing your Together commitment. Some of you are like, I have no idea what Together is. You just simply, we want you to give an offering at the end of the year towards multiply so that we could see the mission and vision multiplied in 2020. So take that next week, pray about it. Hey, as we close today, I want to share this one final thing. As we're thinking about 2020, as we're thinking about, hey, what is it going to take to fuel the mission in 2020? Here's one of the biggest risks that I think that we face as a church. It's this: to see a movement of God turn into a monument of what God did. Just get that in your hearts. To see a movement of God, we have seen a movement of God at our church. Over 1,150 people baptized over the last 7 years. To see a movement of God turn into a monument of what God did in the past. That we would only look back and say, God, that was awesome. That was so great. You remember the heyday when God did this. but that we would see a movement of God moving forward into the future. And the big difference between a movement and a monument is this difference between first generation and second generation faith. Let me close by sharing the difference. You see, when a church sees a lot of people come to faith and there's kids that come to faith within the church, it's very easy, and you see this throughout the Bible, for there to be this first generation faith that's willing to sacrifice it all, and then this second generation faith of people that were sort of born in the house that take for granted everything that's happened among them, and they become sort of complacent in their faith. I was at the Summit Church, just happened to be there about a year ago, and Pastor JD was preaching a sermon. He used this as an example, this difference between first generation and second generation faith. Let me share this with you, and then we'll close. He said, first generation is committed to the mission. Second generation does only what I'm asked to do. First generation assumes personal responsibility. They own the mission. Second generation assumes someone else will do it. We've all been there. First generation asks, what's the most I can sacrifice for the mission? Like, God, can I sacrifice more? Can I give more? Can I serve more? Can I give more time for the mission? The second generation asks, what's the least I can sacrifice for the mission? Tell me the lowest bar so that I can hit it. First generation sees possibilities and dreams about what could be. Second generation sees barriers. They see reasons to quit. First generation steps out with bold, reckless trust in God. Second generation sits satisfied in the stability of the institution. That could be us. It could be so easy. A church our size, almost 3,000 people, four campuses, to sit just satisfied in the institution. Like, it just looks like it's all going great. But instead, just imagine those 1,150 people that have gotten baptized over the last 7 years. If those people are like, hey, I want to have that first generation faith. Like the people that came here to plant Mercy Hill and everything that we've seen, that's what the faith I want to have. I want to be all in terms of first generation faith. Imagine what we could see in 2020. These things that I shared, what we hope to see in 2020, if we were all in for the mission, those things would probably seem very small, because God would probably do so much more than we can ever ask or imagine. Let's close by praying together. Lord, I thank you that I am here today, God. The fact that we all are here today is evidence that you have worked in our life. The fact that we're sitting here, that I'm standing here, God, it's evidence that you have worked in our life. You have called us to yourself. You have shown us so much grace and mercy, and we didn't deserve any of that. We were the widow, God. We were totally incapable to pay off the debt that we owed, but you did it for us, God. And the thing that we get in Christianity, Jesus, is that we get you. And when we get you, there's nothing we're not willing to not hold back. Because in having you, we have everything in this world, God. So I pray, God, whatever it is today, you'd help us to take that step of faith, God. You're not always going to show us. You're not always going to confirm. You're not always going to tell us to do it, God. But let us take that step of faith and learn and experience what it's like to trust you, to experience you. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Hey guys, thanks for stopping by our YouTube channel. We hope that this message is encouraging to you. We hope it stirs up your affections for Christ. If it's doing that, we would encourage you to subscribe to our channel. You can also share this message. If it's working in your life, maybe God wants to use it in somebody else's life, so you can always do that. Let me say a quick word to those of you who might be seeing this for the first time, or maybe you've been following our YouTube channel or listening to our teaching, but you haven't quite made that jump to come into the church yet. We know in today's society, most people listen to the teaching ministry of a church before they ever check it out. So we know that might be a lot of people out there. If that's you, I would just encourage you to take that step. If you don't have a local church, man, don't rely on a teaching ministry on YouTube to be the local church, because it's not the local church. We would love for you to come in and plug in, to use your gifts, to get into some relationships where people can actually push on you, and you can be ministering in their life. There's no such thing as a Lone Ranger Christian. So, man, come join us. Take that step. We would love to meet you. Last thing I would say is this. Hey, we know, guys, that the mission of God goes about as far as the generosity of God's people takes it. If this message is a blessing to you, or if you could see how it could be used in other people's lives, we would really encourage you to financially support the ministry here at Mercy Hill. And you can do that by going to mercyhillchurch.com and going right to our give page and giving there. We'd love to see that happen as we continue to expand. All right, thanks a lot, guys. See you next time.